Welcome to the China in the World podcast, a series of discussions examining China's foreign policy and shifting engagement with the world. Brought to you by the Carnegie Tsinghua Center in Beijing and hosted by Paul Hanley.
Welcome back to the Carnegie Tsinghua's China in the World podcast. I hope everyone is staying safe and doing well during this global pandemic. I'm delighted today to welcome to the podcast, Ali Wine. Ali is currently a senior analyst with Eurasia Group's global macro team. But I would note right at the top that he is a former junior fellow at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. He did that from 2008 to 2009. He joins the ranks of George Stephanopoulos, Samantha Power, Dr. Evan Medeiros, and a range of other distinguished alums from the Junior Fellow Program. Ali is a keen observer of the U.S.-China relationship. He's also an expert on U.S. grand strategy and he's a rising star in U.S. foreign policy circles. As he knows, I think quite highly of his work and have been following it very closely. I think he does great work. He's also at the Atlantic Council, where he serves as a non-resident senior fellow at the Scowcroft Center for Strategy and Security. And from January to July of 2013, he was part of a small team that helped prepare Samantha Power, that former junior fellow at the Carnegie Endowment, for her confirmation hearing to be U.S. ambassador to the United Nations. Ali also served on RAND's adjunct staff, where he worked with the late Richard Solomon on its strategic rethink series. That was from 2014 to 2015. And he returned to RAND in 2017 as a policy analyst there until 2020. He's got a bachelor's from MIT and a master's in public policy from the Harvard Kennedy School, where he was a course assistant to Joe Nye, who's been a participant in the Carnegie Tsinghua Center's activities over the years. Ali, thank you very much for joining us today. I'm looking forward to this discussion.
Well, Paul, thank you so much for having me. I'm delighted to be here.
Ali, we were fortunate to have you write a piece for the Carnegie Endowment website and on U.S.-China relations, where you lay out four principles to guide U.S. policy toward China. It comes at a very timely point. We have a new president coming into office, a new administration, and that will carry with it a new national security and foreign policy team. And so your recommendations are well-timed as usual. I wanna sort of, before we get into each of the principles, I just wanna have you set the stage for us and how you see the current state of U.S.-China relations. You mentioned in the piece, and I would encourage our listeners to read it. It's on the Carnegie website. It's called Four Principles to Guide U.S. Policy Toward China. You talk about an inflection point in the bilateral relationship. You mention, as others have mentioned, that we're at probably the lowest level in terms of the bilateral relationship since the normalization in 1979. And you talk about the relationship having morphed from competitive coexistence into one of systemic antagonism. So if you will, just share with our listeners, you know, your sense of where things stand, how they got to where they are, before we talk about each of your principles.
Sure. Well, Paul, thank you again for having me on the podcast. I'm a big fan of the podcast, a big fan of the center, and of course, a big fan of you and your work. I've learned tremendously from your work over the years. So to have the chance to engage with you one-on-one is a real privilege. So, I hasten to note at the outset that prior to 2020, which, as you said, I think observers widely would mark it as an inflection point, the relationship had already, prior to the pandemic, had already been trending downwards. And I think, depending on which observers you speak to, there's some observers who date the real emergence of frictions in the relationship all the way back to the global financial crisis back in 2008. And there was a feeling that 2008 marked another inflection point. There was a sense that America's macroeconomic stewardship had taken, its credibility as a macroeconomic steward had taken a significant hit, that at least some prominent Chinese officials and observers believed that the global financial crisis marked or at least illuminated the reality, according to Beijing, of terminal systemic American decline. So there's some observers who, you know, depending on who you talk to, they say that the current downward trajectory in relations dates back considerably longer. But certainly with the, you know, with the arrival of, so there was a financial crisis, and then certainly the relationship, it grew more fractious, it grew more contentious over the Obama administration. Although I would say that across both terms of the Obama administration, I think one could reasonably characterize relationship as being one of competitive coexistence. There were certainly growing tensions between Washington and Beijing in a range of domains, China's actions in the South China Sea, concerns over cyber espionage for commercial gain, a range of issues. But the United States and China still, during the Obama administration, were able to ink a number of quite significant cooperative achievements, particularly in the realms of climate change and cyberspace. And they did commit to an abstract, but nonetheless promising idea of a new model of great power relations. I think that with the arrival of the Trump administration, the relationship began trending downwards at a much at an accelerating pace, and for a number of reasons. I think the Trump administration came into office believing that one of the fundamental precepts that had guided U.S. policy towards China for the better part of the past four decades was unfounded, whereas Republican and Democratic administrations prior to the Trump administration, had largely regarded trade and technological entanglement as a force for, not as a panacea, but as a force for imparting some baseline stability to the relationship. The Trump administration came in feeling that that interdependence had actually benefited China at America's expense. It believed that China had taken advantage of American openness, and it believed that there was a need to renegotiate and recalibrate fundamentally the terms of the relationship. It regarded America's strategy towards China as having been predicated upon misguided, illusory notions. Mm-hmm. And it believed that China, in particular, believed that China's technological progression posed not only an economic challenge, but also arguably more importantly, a national security challenge. And you see in the 2017 National Security Strategy and the 2018 National Defense Strategy, a quite explicit rejection of past premises that had guided mm-hmm. U.S. policy. Mm-hmm. Then from Beijing's perspective, of course, Beijing wasn't acting in a vacuum, and Beijing's increasingly assertive conduct in and beyond the Asia-Pacific, or I guess now the Indo-Pacific, depending on your preferred parlance, its increasing assertiveness certainly predated the Trump administration. But I think that with the arrival of the Trump administration, China believed that in response to the imposition of tariffs, the administration's actions against Huawei, China increasingly as well began to see interdependence as a national security liability. And so prior to the pandemic, if we look at bookend number one, the arrival of the Trump administration, bookend number two, the onset of the pandemic, the relationship had been trending downwards, and I think at an accelerating pace. But even at the beginning of 2020, It seems like it might as well have been a decade ago psychologically, but you remember in mid-January, the United States and China signed this phase one trade deal. And there was a sense that the phase one trade deal offered, if not a fundamental reversal in the relationship, at least it offered a temporary reprieve. And there was some optimism that attended the deal in both Washington and Beijing.
Go ahead. No, I was just going to say, I just wanted to, before I lose track, I think you've made an important point early on, and I just want to, before we lose that, you talked about the global financial crisis and you know, the impact on, you know, the perceptions in China of the U.S. as a global actor. And, you know, I often talk about this as well. I agree very much with you that this had a pretty profound impact on Beijing's confidence, frankly, in the US's ability to manage the financial and economic system of the world, kind of be the leader in that effort. And I was in the White House at the time as the China director. And I remember when the economic folks in the National Security Council and in the White House were strongly urging the president to call the Chinese president at the time, Hu Jintao, to say, hey, we've got to coordinate here or this thing could spiral out of control. There were folks on the strategic side who said, you know, we need to think twice before we kind of let Beijing understand that they've got a lot of leverage in this particular situation. Like, this could be a game changer. And in the end, the president, because of his desire to get the financial crisis under control, the first phone call he made was to the Chinese president. And there was some collaboration there. But it, I think it does, you know, represent a real significant mark. I would also put, you know, the 2016 presidential election in there and our dysfunctional politics as another marker, not on the economic side, obviously, but on the political side in terms of China's perceptions. And I would also, and I think I heard you say this, but a lot of these frictions with China actually came up at the end of the Obama administration, sort of second term, right? So these are not new to the Trump administration, this, these challenges with China. And I wanted to just make sure, put a fine point on that point that you made. But clearly the Trump administration did come in, as you suggest, and it really challenged the concept and the approach of engagement that, as you say, they felt was based on false assumptions that as we engage China and bring China in, that it would evolve politically and economically in ways that were in our own interest, and that clearly didn't happen. I would just say that my own view is, because I was part of that effort, I don't think they were ever assumptions that we thought these things would happen, you know, without any doubt. Certainly, I would say they were based on a hope that China would evolve that way. And I think maybe it's a, it was a you know, an unrealistic hope, but nevertheless, it wasn't, I don't think, an assumption that this would inevitably happen. And I would just say too, it's not, it was just not just a hope of Americans. Frankly, it's a hope of a lot of Chinese that China would evolve in those ways. And I think to your last point about China's contributions to the downturn and the relationship, I think the evolution and trajectory of China's political system, its economic system, and its now new international approach is also having a significant impact in terms of the downturn that we see in relations with the United States. It's not, as you're saying, I would argue, not just the Trump administration, not just Donald Trump himself.
No, not at all. And I think that this point that you make, the point that you just made, it reminded me of a piece that I was recently rereading, not reading, rereading, by Neil Thomas at Macro Polo. And he's a really nice piece. When did he publish it? I'm forgetting the exact date of publication, but he basically talks about what he very meticulously surveys what it was that proponents of U.S. proponents of so-called engage but hedge mantra, what was it that they actually said? Mm-hmm. What was it that they actually said the policy entailed? And what was it that they actually hoped to accomplish? What was it that they believed that they might accomplish? And I think that this distinction that you posit is a critical one, namely between hopes and assumptions. I think there may well be some observers who assumed, particularly in the kind of the triumphalist halo of the immediate post-Cold War, or in the immediate aftermath of the Soviet Union's dissolution, there may well have been some observers in the immediate aftermath of that quite dramatic event who may have argued that with time, in due course, China would inexorably, as it grew more integrated into the global economy, that it would, of course, inexorably grow more politically pluralistic. But my hunch is that far more observers hoped that China would evolve in a certain direction, and that it would evolve in that direction in a piecemeal, incremental, nonlinear fashion. And I would also, I would just add one point to extend the point that you just made, and this is drawing on some articles and book chapters that I've been recently reading. One is a recent article by John Culver at the Lowy Institute, and another is an essay and a book chapter by Elizabeth Economy. And they both make the point that to pronounce America's erstwhile policy towards China a failure, implicit in that conclusion is that Xi Jinping's China marks the sort of the culmination of China's political evolution, that China henceforth will not politically evolve, that it is, but the point that, you know, John Culver makes the point in his Lowy Institute piece that just in the past, you know, four decades since, you know, opening up in the Deng Xiaoping era, that China has gone through various stages of political reform, that the CCP's fortunes have waxed and waned during that period. And Elizabeth Economy as well makes the point, she has a slightly different emphasis, but she says that given the time horizons that we're talking about, you know, given that, you know, China, depending on how you count its history, is, you know, several thousand years old, to focus on a 40-year period out of that several thousand right. period and say that its political evolution is finished, it seems slightly premature.
Yeah, and I think that's right. And thanks for bringing up Neil Thomas. Neil's been active with the Carnegie Tsinghua Center over the years, and I follow his work at Macro Polo and encourage our listeners to do the same. John Culver, I worked very closely with in government, and I have very high regard for Liz Economy. So I'd encourage all our listeners to read those articles that Ali mentioned. And I think just to emphasize again, the point that I was making was based on a hope, and that hope has not transpired. But the fact that it has not transpired is also evidence. You know, I had a Chinese scholar say to me one time, Paul, you have to realize that when China announced its reform and opening up, just days later, it announced the normalization of relations with the United States. Those two, in the Chinese view, are deeply interlinked. And this particular scholar said, given that China is walking away from that reform and opening up and sort of moving in a very different direction, it's no surprise to me, he said, that it's having very negative impact on the U.S.-China relationship. It's sort of one of the closest things I have found to a more self-reflective approach in China of thinking about China's own contributions to the downturn in the relationship. So I would say to, you know, those that are re-examining engagement, yes, they're right. The result was not what we had hoped for, but that result is also a major factor in why the relationship is, I think, deteriorating. And so whether, you know, if we, our ability to get this relationship back on track depends then quite a bit on what China does going forward.
Absolutely, absolutely. And I'm sure that we'll discuss this point more as our conversation continues, but it's, I think that just basic intuition dictates that in any relationship, whether we're talking about a relationship between two individuals or whether we're talking about a relationship between two countries, as the expression goes, it takes two to tango. And I certainly sense, I'm betraying my, you know, my biases as an American, but I do believe that there has been, considerably more willingness among American observers to criticize U.S. policy towards China across different administrations, to engage in introspection, to acknowledge where certain U.S. policies might have either been misguided or certain U.S. policies might have been more confrontational than competitive. I haven't seen, and this goes back to what we were discussing a little bit before our conversation began, I haven't seen a parallel intensity of introspection among high-level Chinese officials, among high-level, you know, Chinese analysts. And I think that there has to be, you know, we often hear the phrase mutual respect. I think that there also has to be mutual reinforcing introspections.
Yeah.
I think that it behooves Washington and Beijing, given that they possess the world's two largest economies, the two largest defense budgets, given their centrality to any agenda for managing transnational challenges, I think it behooves both of them to examine how and why the relationship has reached its current level, what they can do to stabilize it. And without we don't need to indulge any illusions about the possibility of a G2 condominium or invest or attach overly great hopes to notions of a great new model of great power relations. But we have to recognize that if the United States and China are either unable or worse, unwilling to restore even a modicum of a cooperative stability to the relationship, the prospects are not only grim for their own relationship, but the prospects for, frankly, for the international system are quite dire. So I hope that we see more introspection on both sides, but I do think I've seen considerably more introspection in Washington than in Beijing.
You know, I totally agree. I think it's hard for governments to be self-reflective, at least publicly. But I do think your main point about, you know, it takes two sides. One of my previous podcasts was with Chinese scholar Chun Ding Ding. And he made the point, it takes two hands to clap. And I would argue over the last several years, neither hand has been clapping. And we do need much more introspection, self-reflection on both sides. I do think that a presidential campaign in the United States is a period where we do a great deal of introspection, where we have a debate on what aspects of Trump's China policy worked and what didn't work. And we're talking a lot now about what a Biden administration could do better to be more effective, and what self-defeating policies the Trump administration pursued that we want to abandon. So I do think in the US that we've been somewhat introspective during this period, in fact, quite publicly. I don't see the same level of introspection in China. I frankly just don't. And I don't mean to be overly critical here, but you know, Mike McFaul, our former ambassador to Russia, came out to the World Peace Forum last summer, and he watched a US-China panel where there was two American scholars and two US scholars. And he said, I hear Americans being constructively critical of the US government. I hear Americans being constructively critical of the Chinese government. I hear Chinese scholars being critical of the US government. I don't hear any Chinese scholars being constructively critical of the Chinese government. Now, you could argue that's hard for them to do at a public event and all the rest, but I do think that your point is right. It's going to require that kind of introspection on both sides to say, you know, what has each side been doing to contribute to the downturn, and what can each side do on its own in the context of its own domestic politics to reposition the relationship and get it on better footing. It can't all come from the United States. And I really desperately hope China understands that. Let's get into your principles, if I could, because I, to be honest, as you and I have talked about offline, I found them to be extremely practical and smart. And number one, find a middle ground between complacence and consternation. And I just want you to explain exactly what you mean here, but I do want to ask specifically, you talk about the importance of, you know, goals and establishing goals that the U.S. should pursue and the policies that it needs to sort of carry out in order to achieve them. You know, in answering this question about what you mean by this principle, if you could talk about what you see as the most important questions for U.S. policymakers to answer as they craft China policy going forward in the Biden administration, you know, what do you see those as in terms of establishing goals? Are these new questions? Have they been part of U.S. policy considerations throughout the relationship? What are new and what are old kind of questions that we need to look at?
Sure. So the basic, and I realized that when I was crafting this particular section on the principle that you just mentioned, there are many more questions that I could have broached in the piece, but the basic, I think that the two basic questions that I think are, they're longstanding, or they're outstanding, and I think that when the United States formulates policy towards China or towards any other country for that matter, I think you have to ask two basic questions. The first question is, what are this country's strategic objectives or their strategic intentions, and secondly, what capabilities, what material capabilities can that country bring to bear in service of those objectives? I think that those are, and each of those questions, one can deconstruct each of those questions then into many other questions, but those are the two big questions. It's objectives and its capabilities. And what I wanted to do, what I tried to do in this particular section was to acknowledge that there is, I think, a a vigorous, and I would say a newly vigorous, debate among U.S. observers about the content, the substance of China's long-term strategic objectives. I wanted to acknowledge that debate, but also just given the given the limitations of space, I wanted to acknowledge that it would have been almost impossible for me to do justice. It would have been impossible for me to do justice to this very rich debate. But I wanted to acknowledge that there's a debate among observers about what China's long-term intentions are. So to what extent can outside observers discern China's long-term strategic objectives? How dispositively do high-level CCP documents establish those intentions? What are those intentions? How fixed are they? To what extent do they respond to various internal and external stimuli, so on and so forth? The kind of the thought exercise or the conceit of this particular section was to stipulate at the outset, let's assume for argument's sake, a maximalist interpretation about China's intentions. Let's stipulate and hold constant its intentions. And let's suppose that it aspires to displace the United States or overtake the United States as the world's preeminent power, that it seeks to overturn the current post-war order and establish a China-centric order. So let's stipulate that maximalist interpretation. And the point of doing that is not to say that those are indeed China's intentions. You may, as I quote Joel Wolf now, and he says that depending on your reading of the available evidence, you may reach that conclusion about its intentions, you may not. But let's stipulate that that's what China intends to do. Then the question becomes, what would their pathways be towards achieving those objectives? And what I wanted to do in this particular section is to acknowledge that China has formidable competitive strengths, and that's why we shouldn't be complacent. So you look at China's, first of all, just its economic heft. So by way of comparison, the Soviet Union at its peak had only about its GDP was only about 40% as large as that of the United States. China in 2019 was approaching 70%, the level of American GDP. And given its current recovery from the pandemic and just extant trends, that proportion is likely to grow. So if you look at its extant economic heft, its degree of integration into the global economy, and not just its economic heft and centrality, but also the technological strides that it's making, China is a formidable economic and technological player. It is deepening its imprint in a range of domains of global governance. And I think that it also, particularly in recovering from the pandemic, it has been exploiting fissures in American society and touting its own recovery from the pandemic to portray itself as domestically competent and to portray Washington as domestically flailing and incompetent. And so China is a formidable player. It's a formidable competitor. And I do think that as Washington formulates, so the reason I say that we should avoid complacence is that there was a tendency, and I think there may still be a tendency in certain quarters, although I think it's much diminished, but there certainly was a tendency, again, in the immediate aftermath of the Cold War, even around the turn of the century, to say that China is—it's going to succumb to a middle-income trap. It's largely incapable of innovating because of its authoritarian system. Mm-hmm. It's going to have a debt bubble that pops. So there was a lot of underestimation, but we're seeing that clearly. The CCP is adaptive. China has defied many prognostications of its disintegration. So the first part of the principle is let's not be complacent. Yeah. But there's a corollary. If complacence isn't a good or sort of a prudent disposition, neither is consternation. And what I spend the most of the time in this section talking about is China's very formidable competitive liabilities, both internally and externally. So internally, the litany is familiar. You look at the demographic outlook, which is quite bleak. You look at environmental degradation. You look at the frailty of, or I shouldn't say the frailty, but you look at some of the brittleness of CCP rule. I thought that Richard McGregor had a really compelling op-ed in the New York Times last month, I think it was on November 9th or November 10th, in which he argued that the seeming facade of Xi Jinping's power actually masks the reality that he actually is paving the way for a potential leadership crisis in decades to come, because he basically has consolidated so much authority, made a lot of enemies in the process, and he's pushed back against the norms of the kind of governance norms that Deng Xiaoping endeavored to entrench. And so the facade of Xi Jinping's power actually masks a certain brittleness of CCP rule. So there are a number of internal competitive liabilities. And then externally, whether you look at China's relationships in the Asia Pacific, whether you look at the limitations that China faces to becoming a self-reliant technological power, the limitations that China faces in establishing a coherent alternative to the post-war order, China faces a number of competitive liabilities. And I would make the argument, and perhaps I'm betraying a certain naivete or ignorance here, there isn't only one path to preeminence, and you can't disclaim the possibility that if we have this conversation 20 or 30 years hence, maybe we will be talking about a China that sits atop the global hierarchy. But naive supposition or premise would be that if China is unable to cultivate a greater baseline of trust in the international community, so if China can't overcome very formidable internal obstacles to assure political and economic stability at home, if it is unable to deal more effectively with Taiwan and Hong Kong and their democratic aspirations and the really inspiring resistance that we've seen in Taiwan and Hong Kong, if it's unable to cultivate a baseline of trust in the international community, then essentially what China will have essentially forsaken all but one path to achieving this national rejuvenation or the great Chinese dream, and that is becoming so central economically and so central technologically that it essentially can just overwhelm opposition, even from countries that have very grave apprehensions about its military footprint, its strategic ambitions. But it seems to me that economic centrality and technological innovation, while being critical for any country's resurgence, they are not in and of themselves sufficient for a country to overtake the world's preeminent power. And so, so the upshot of the first principle is, let's acknowledge China's formidable competitive strengths, I think particularly economically and technologically. Let's recognize that China has defied many prognostications of decline. Let's acknowledge that the CCP has proven far more adaptive than many observers might have believed. But let's not discount its competitive liabilities either. And I think that you can't sort of conduct a neat sort of net assessment in which you sort of net out China's competitive liabilities from its assets. Gauging comprehensive national power is always a fraught endeavor. But if I had to sort of give a sort of a summary, it would be that, and I think I quote in the piece, I like this line from Jude Blanchett. He said that if you look at China's competitive strengths and if you look at its competitive liabilities and you juxtapose them, China isn't, it's not 10 feet tall, it's not 2 feet tall, it's 6'9". When you're dealing with a competitor that's 6'9", that's a serious competitor.
Yep.
But it's not so overwhelming a competitor that it completely overwhelms your ability to formulate strategy. So that's the upshot of the first principle.
Don't underestimate, don't overestimate. Clearly,
exactly.
As you suggest, China has real competitive strengths, but also real competitive liabilities. And the liabilities, I think we see play out in the rising anti-China global sentiment. Yeah. I mean, this is not going to be helpful for China as it tries to expand its influence and presence on the world stage. It's going to be an obstacle and a deterrent. And this will create problems. I'm reminded of, I had a great opportunity a year ago to go to New York and sit down with a small group and talk to Henry Kissinger on China. And it was, he started out and talking about different aspects and, sometimes he often doesn't directly come to the point that he really wants you to take away. He'll kind of talk around it and you have to come away with the point yourself. But he spent some time at the beginning of our discussion talking about in the early days of the Cold War when he was an academic and he would go down to Washington and he would sit in different sessions talking about the Soviet Union. And he said, the way the Soviet Union was talked about in those policy discussions, you would think that the Soviet Union would be taking over the world in just short order. And we realized over time that the Soviet Union had some real inherent weaknesses, which ultimately led to its demise. His point, I think, if I had to guess, was we shouldn't make the same mistake with China. We shouldn't sort of paint, over describe China's strengths and turn it into this 10-foot giant, because we need to recognize there's both strengths and weaknesses. And I think it's a great point. And it's a much more nuanced point than I think we've been able to sort of see penetrate over the last several years. The dialogue on China has become sort of more black and white. And I think we need to get back to the point where we can have more complexities and nuances. Your second point in principle in the article was to embed US-China within a broader vision. And in this piece, you talk about, you know, rather than pursuing a defensive policy towards Beijing, Washington should pursue an affirmative policy, one that would help it determine where and how a selective contestation with China would advance that vision. So in describing this principle, if you could talk a little bit about the distinction between affirmative and defensive China policy as you see it.
So, and I hasten to note before diving into the sort of the meat of my answer, I think that the impulse for a more, or the impulse towards a more defensive or reactionary strategy, it's understandable in light of not only the scale of China's resurgence, but the scope and the rapidity. I certainly understand why a growing number of observers argue that China is now, it is our central competitor. And if you look at its particularly its economic proportions, and if you look at its, not only its economic proportions, but also its ideological precepts, I understand the impulse to cast China as the new sort of overarching, you know, competitor that should orient our foreign policy. But what I worry about is that as important as the management of China's resurgence is and will remain to the conduct of US foreign policy, China is not the only major power with which the United States needs to deal. There are many other major powers. And so there are a number of risks of a strategy of a US foreign policy that is China-centric. The first is that when you make a foreign policy, when you orient it around the actions of another country, you're ceding strategic initiative. And so if I say that the principal objective or one of the principal objectives of my foreign policy is to repel Chinese advances, then you're essentially waiting to see what they do and don't do. You're beholden to what Beijing is doing. And it's not only that, so you not only place yourself in a strategically defensive position, but I think that you also signal to your allies and partners that you're proceeding from a place of anxiety rather than confidence. Mm-hmm. And you are further signaling to those allies and partners that you perhaps are losing confidence in the singularity and the enduring power of your own unique competitive strengths, of which the United States has many. And I also suspect that, and of course, you know, I've already mentioned a number of times allies and partners, but I think that allies and partners, you know, we often and rightly talk about allies and partners, our diplomatic network, as being one of America's critical, so singular competitive strengths. And I suspect that allies and partners would be far more likely to make common cause of the United States, to make commitments to the United States as part of an affirmative agenda that thinks about what would the contours of a post-pandemic world order look like, rather than as being instrumentalized as part of a coalition to contain China. And going back to a point I was making earlier, even many countries that have grave apprehensions about China's strategic intentions are not prepared to decouple necessarily to the same extent as the United States. By virtue of their geographic proximity, by virtue of their extant economic dependence on China, they might not have the luxury. And so the point is that we first need to think about where it is that we're trying to go. And I think that we really need to have a serious conversation about not just the challenges that we're trying to manage, but the objectives that we're trying to achieve. And I realize that the challenges that we're trying to manage and the objectives we're trying to achieve, they're not mutually exclusive. There's a lot of overlap. But, you know, an affirmative policy would say, you know, here is where the international system stands. Here is what needs to be done to make it more resilient in the face of both sort of long-term sort of slow brew or sort of slow boil transnational challenges, as well as to make it more resilient in face of emergency crises? How can the United States position itself so that Washington, along with its allies and partners, that they are poised to mobilize collective action in response to those challenges? What needs to be done to reconfigure the international system to that end, whether it's modifying existing institutions, creating new institutions, involving non-governmental actors in the fights against transnational challenges? And once we have a sense of what it is that we would like to do, where we would like to go, then I think that we can decide where do we need to push back against China more forcefully? Where do we not react? Because the reality is that there are going to be, not everything that China does is intrinsically inimical to American national interests by virtue of bearing Beijing's imprimatur. There will undoubtedly be instances in which we need to push back more forcefully and be somewhat reactive. So, I think I list a few in this piece, but certainly the United States does need to do more to reduce its reliance on China for inputs of vital commodities, and that involves a renegotiation of the terms of interdependence. The United States does need to ensure that other countries that have territorial, or the China's neighbors that have claims in the South China Sea and the East China Sea, that they feel confident in pushing back against Chinese assertiveness. And so there are a number of ways, and then one last point would be that certainly the United States needs to make clear that freedom of expression for its citizens, its companies, is sacrosanct, and that any Chinese diplomatic overture that would be predicated upon a stifling of free speech of American citizens or companies would be a non-starter. So there are certainly areas in which the United States will need to respond directly to China's resurgence. But I would argue that if the United States, and Jessica Chen Weiss and I made this argument in a recent op-ed, that the core of U.S. strategy towards China should be an asymmetric strategy that doubles down on America's competitive strengths rather than trying to replicate what China is doing. But again, just to summarize, thinking about where we want to go so that we are offering an affirmative vision, and this is also one of the lessons of the Cold War, to the extent that we want to draw on lessons from the Cold War. I think some lessons are maybe not as applicable as others, but I think the one core lesson is it's not enough to say what it is that you find objectionable about your competitor's conduct. It's essential, particularly when you're trying to build a coalition, to say not only what you stand against, but what you affirmatively stand for. And so that's sort of the upshot of the second principle. And I think that if we can signal to our allies and partners that we are thinking seriously about managing the China challenge, but we are doing so within the context of a broader consideration of what we would like the international system to look like to deal with a very daunting set of transnational challenges, I think that that type of framing would be more compelling.
I think it's an important principle, Ollie. And I, you know, one of the things that I think about in this context is the discussions that I've had with, you know, foreign diplomats in Beijing, other Americans who ask me, you know, they say, look, we understand the Trump administration has highlighted, you know, a number of areas where China is challenging the United States or others in the international community, where China is, through its policies and actions, you know, undermining our own interests. And they've highlighted areas that were identified in the Obama administration, but highlighted new areas. And so, but the question I often get is, to what end? You know, where are they trying to go? And this, I think, gets to your point, which is, what is the vision? And I would often get asked, you know, is this part of an effort to conduct some sort of regime change with China? And you're left sort of wondering, is it simply to prove to Americans and the international community that China is malign, that China is bad? What are we supposed to do with this? And this is, I think, gets at the heart of your principle. Embed this policy within a broader vision, an affirmative one where you're trying to go, and have the strategy tied to resources and a broad, you know, governmental approach, working with partners and allies. And I think to a certain extent, you know, the Biden administration, if they can kind of systematize and institutionalize some of these aspects could be ultimately much more effective. The other point that I just want to put a fine point, I think, in terms of what I hear you saying, and Lucas Chan, my research assistant, and I, we've talked about this issue of a stable U.S.-China relationship, and I've made the point. I don't think our goal should necessarily be, you know, a stable U.S.-China relationship, because it's increasingly clear that we're going to have to accept a degree, we're going to have to be tolerant of friction in the relationship in order to push on areas where we need to get China to change or to adjust or to modify its behavior in order to advance U.S. interests. And so stability is, I mean, obviously we don't want conflict, military conflict, or excessive sort of confrontation for the sake of confrontation, but we have to, I think, be open and tolerant to the notion that this is a new China. You know, they're not necessarily going to change just because we and others ask it to. We may have to accept some friction. And I think I heard you mention some of that in your description as well.
And just, I think on this last point that you just made, it's in terms of dealing with the new China, it's what I found quite striking, and again, maybe, you know, betraying a certain naivete, what has been striking is that it's not only that, not only that China embarked upon this sort of this course of wolf warrior diplomacy, but that at least based on, you know, conversations I've had and what I've read thus far, there don't seem to be even incipient signs of recalibration, even though it's clear that this course of diplomacy has alienated Canberra, it's alienated Delhi, it's alienated Tokyo, it's alienated Seoul. And what I found striking is, what's striking is China has demonstrated that it is willing to incur, and whether it feels that it has sufficient comprehensive national power to assert itself without paying heed to external reactions, whether it feels aggrieved, whether it believes that it has a certain window of opportunity to advance what it deems to be core national interests, whatever the reasons might be, that China has demonstrated that it is willing to incur quite tremendous reputational damage in pursuit of certain national interests. I've been quite struck, especially because if we wind back the clock to maybe the first quarter of this year, so sort of circa maybe late February, you know, early March, the narrative around that time was that China had basically contained the first wave of the pandemic, the coronavirus pandemic. Its economy was embarked on this nascent recovery while the United States was flailing. And I think that at that time, China had really an extraordinary opportunity, had it exercised greater restraint. China had an extraordinary opportunity, I think, to further advance the Belt and Road Initiative, to secure more inroads for Huawei and other Chinese telecommunications companies, to boost its overall diplomatic stature. And yet it engaged in this rather remarkable course of diplomatic self-sabotage, even though it had this amazing set of opportunities. So I agree with you. We are dealing with a new China, and a China that it is willing. It's not just that it's not as responsive to unilateral U.S. pressure as Washington might hope, but that it's prepared to incur significant reputational costs.
Thanks for listening to part one of this two-part podcast with Ali Wine. Tune in 2 weeks from now to hear Ali and I discuss his third and fourth principles: repositioning abroad and rebuilding at home, and striving for a durable cohabitation.
Thank you for listening to the China in the World podcast. For more episodes and research, please go to carnegiechinghua.org. This episode was produced by Lucas Chayan, with assistance from Madison Reed, Luke Incarnation, Li Chi Shu, John Ferguson, and Sophia Rosso.